Okay, we covered a lot of ground already. So you have a feel of what service systems thinking is. You have kind of the domain knowledge. The question is now, if we think about trying to improve systems, how is it that we actually do that? And I'm going to talk about general pattern language. And this is a work that I've been doing over the past year and a half. And it's based off work in architecture from the 1970s. So I'll talk a little bit about wholeness, which is quality without a name. I'll talk about unfolding. And I'm going to talk about the Aishin Campus Project based off the work of Christopher Alexander. So Christopher Alexander is an architect, architectural theorist. If you search on Christopher Alexander on YouTube, you'll find he's 70 years old now. He's very well known. He was a professor at Berkeley. And for those of you who've worked in computer science or in IT, you may have heard of pattern language before. There was a book that was called Pattern Language. And what happened was that the software world adopted the idea of pattern language as a way of communicating. And so I'm proposing we could do that with a service system, but if we look at the way that Alexander thinks about aesthetics, he was working a lot on architecture, but he wrote a book at a certain point about Turkish carpets, because he said, if you had to choose between these two carpets as a picture of yourself, which one of the two carpets would you choose? Do you prefer the carpet on the left or the carpet on the right? Now, this experiment has been done, and it turns out that most people prefer one over the other. The studies that I've heard, so Richard Gabriel is one of the people in computer science that does this experiment, and says that most people prefer one, except that he goes and he does this with computer science people, and computer science people are random because they're kind of blind. They don't have the sense of aesthetics, but most people prefer one or the other. But when Alexander asks the question more deeply, he says, let me clarify by asking you to choose which one seems better able to represent your whole being, the essence of yourself, good and bad, all that's human in you. When you are making these choices, these are not rational choices. Do you like the carpet on the left or the carpet on the right? It's not rational. It's emotional, aesthetic. And service systems are very much like that. You could complain that a service is too slow, but you could also complain a service is sometimes too fast. I don't know if ever you've been in a restaurant where the service is too fast. You haven't finished your course yet and you feel rushed because they keep bringing the meals to you. So there are things that are quantitative and there are things that are not quantitative when you're talking about service systems. And that's the interesting thing about looking into this. So Christopher Alexander wrote a lot of books. And the three famous books he wrote came between 1975 and 1979. The most famous one is called A Pattern Language. You can go to almost any library in the world and you'll find these yellow-covered books. And A Pattern Language is the best one that's known. It's called Towns Building Construction. And what it does is it lists patterns that are known that he sees. And I'll give you an example in the middle in a minute. The Oregon experiment is actually the design plan for the University of Oregon campus. The University of Oregon was looking for a way to plan their university campus, and he wrote a book about it. And the timeless way of building was about building construction. How is it that you build in a timeless way? People in computer science took this and they used it in software development. There are criticisms about the way they used it because they don't necessarily have the aesthetic sense. Using pattern language does not make necessarily better software, let's put it that way, from the user perspective. The one I recommend, on 2012 though, he wrote this book called The Battle for Life and Beauty of the Earth. It's his last book. He's 70 years old. It's been floating around for a long time. And it's a story of him actually building a university high school campus in Japan and fighting the Japanese construction industry. So I recommend it. When I went to the Pattern Language Conference and they hadn't read this book yet because they thought it was too violent. And I said, no, this is the best book of all of them. The problem I have with reading his old stuff is it's very theoretical. And what I see in the Battle for Life of Beauty is you can actually see how Christopher Alexander actually designed a university campus, a high school campus. And I'm going to go through a little bit of that with you and share that. But what is a pattern? Here's a definition. A short and necessarily incomplete definition of pattern. It is recurring structural configuration that solves a problem in context, contributing to the wholeness of some whole or system that reflects some aesthetic or cultural value. So now that you've been through the discussion on systems thinking, you may see some words there. Wholeness, you kind of get the ideas of parts. We haven't talked about problems or context yet. Context is like a containing whole. But there's this language that's there. And Christopher Alexander, one of the blog posts I have on coevolving.com on my blog, is Christopher Alexander as a system thinker. System thinkers, a read doesn't go, this guy's obviously a system thinker. He's using the language in a certain way, and it makes a lot of sense. But then you have one of the bad system thinkers, I say, that go, oh, we're going to use pattern language. And they use a pattern language, but they forget this part, contributing to the wholeness of some whole. So they take a service, and they add something to the service, and it makes it worse. Maybe they should remove that. Maybe they should focus on the whole. Right? So the way the pattern is normally done, you have a pattern name, and if you look in the book, it has a name. There's a problem, and the problem fits inside a context. I'm gonna have some issues with this. Christopher Alexander's a good start, but he needs a few changes when you move from architecture to services. So this is for architecture. He has a architectural problem. Like a wall is in the wrong place, or the space is too small, or there's too much sunlight, or there's congestion, any sort of thing you could do in architecture or planning. There's a context in which it happens. There is a solution to that problem. You make a choice when you build a building. So I talked about the pacing layers, building closets versus having armoires. There are forces that you take into account that you choose one way or the other because you're trying to optimize one way or improve another way. There is a resulting context after you've done this. There is a rationale that explains why in this situation you would choose this design pattern, and there could be other patterns associated with patterns. So let me see if I can get a little bit concrete with this. In a pattern language, there is pattern 127 called intimacy gradient. Let me give you the story about this, which is kind of filled out. Normally, when you come to a house is designed on an intimacy gradient. So you have the front door, and you have your doorstep. Someone knocks on the door. Hardly anyone knocking on the door ever makes it through the door. They're all strangers. Okay? If it's raining, you say, okay, the mailman's here, I've seen you many times, come in while I sign for the package, get out of the rain. They get to the hallway, right? When your friends come, they get past the hallway and they get to the living room. And if it's a good party, then they end up in your kitchen, right? Everyone's in the kitchen. Very few people ever see the bedroom. And if you're having a party and it's, you know, if you have to clean up and the last thing to do, the bedroom's a mess, right? You clean up the living room, you clean up the kitchen, the bedroom's still a mess because everyone goes there. The intimacy gradient is designed that way, and there's always that structure. And if you design it in a different way, it just feels wrong. So I don't know how many of you have been to an apartment when you open the door and the apartment's so small you see the bed. It's just like, that's weird. Or people that put the bedroom in the front of the house and they don't put curtains in it, that's weird, right? Or, you know, these sorts of things. So there's ways of designing that seem more natural. And so intimacy gradient is one of those ways of doing it. And what Alexander says in the lower left here, unless the spaces in the building are arranged in a sequence which corresponds to degrees of privateness, the visits made by strangers, friends, guests, clients, family will always seem a little bit awkward. So it's something that when someone points it out to you, you go, yes, of course. But it's like, well, sometimes you can't explain it. And next time you walk into someone's bedroom, you'll kind of go, oh, now I know why this feels strange. I'm not really supposed to be here. If you, there is a website, you guys have access to the slide, so you can look at this, and this is the intimacy gradient, and they have higher order patterns and lower order patterns. Remember when I talked about systems thinking, I talked about containing whole. A containing whole is a super system. Then you have subsystems underneath it inside. So the patterns can be sequenced that way, where there are higher order patterns and there are lower order patterns. So there are buildings within cities, there are cities within regions, all these sorts of things happen. And there's intimacy gradient in social media. So I don't know how you people use social media. I'll tell you how I use social media. For me, Facebook is something that very few people actually get on my Facebook. I don't friend many people. And when you go Google me on Google, you'll find that I'm like one of the easiest people to find because I'm really, really public. You know, I tweet that I'm here. I actually tweeted I'm in this building, so people know where I am. But on Facebook, I use it for my family and people who are close friends. If you want to engage me, you can find me on Google Plus. Google Plus is an asymmetric follow, and so that's for people that I don't know as well. And if you follow me on Google, I don't have to follow you back. And so I do most of my posting on Google Plus for that reason. I don't like the noise that happens in Facebook because that's a symmetric follow. And on Facebook, I follow you, you follow me. On Google Plus, I follow you, you may or may not follow me. It's asymmetric. Then we have LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. I have this rule, which is interesting, that I actually don't connect to people on LinkedIn unless I've met them and I've had a conversation with them in person. That's an interesting test. So when someone says, you know, do you actually know this person on LinkedIn? It's like, I actually do. So there's the gradient. There's actually an interesting other gradient, which is I travel a lot and I have this habit. I originally come from a restaurant family when I was young. And so the ultimate intimacy gradient is if you've eaten my cooking, then you're really close. So we'll see if any of you get to that state. Maybe you guys do some research work for me and you can get invited for dinner. But if you've eaten my cooking, then you're really close. If you're on Facebook, there's another gradient. If you're on LinkedIn, that's further, and then everyone can get to me on Google. Okay? That's a pattern that started in physical architecture and has been used now in social media. It's a different context. But we can use that sort of thing in a service sense as well, and I'd like to do that. So can we create better service systems learning inductively from an architecting built environment? So I'm going to steal a little bit from your next lecture. On research methods. How many of you know about deduction, induction, and abduction? Anyone? Good, we have one scholar. Okay, I'm going to give you the shortest lesson ever on this. There are three ways of reasoning. Deduction, you have the rule, you have the case and the result. And so deduction is a typical way that we do science. We have a scientific theory, which is a rule. You find the case, and so if you are doing your thesis, you have a theory, and you say, this organization did not change because the economy hit this. And they couldn't do an organizational change because they couldn't afford and couldn't adjust in time. You do your case study, and you say it follows the theory, and that's the result. Okay? That's one way of doing thesis work. You start with a theory, and then you apply the data against it. The second one is induction. You start off with the case. There's a phenomenon out there, and you can't necessarily explain it, but you see the results of it. And so my dissertation is on open sourcing while private sourcing. IBM has, between the years 2001 and 2011, when I'm doing my research, was doing a lot of open source work. They were giving software away in effect in public. Very profitable company. It's a phenomenon. Is there a theory of open sourcing while private sourcing? No, there isn't one. No one has explained it. Okay, I need an inductive case study method to solve that one. I'm doing research about it. And you could say, oh, is IBM the only one that's ever done this? No, you look at Google, Android is open source. So, and Google is doing the same thing as IBM. Not part of my dissertation. But inductive case study starts from the case. I see this phenomenon, I have the result, And I'm trying to generate the rule or the theory. So it's a theory building activity. Abduction. Abduction, the best way of describing this is like a science fiction movie. You watch the movie, you watch The Matrix. Okay? So if The Matrix was to happen, then what would the rule be? What would have to happen so that The Matrix would happen? And it would have to do with the machines take over, all these sort of things, all this stuff. And then you get the case, which is actually what happens, right? So there's more than one future that could happen. So if we are going to do work on industrial systems, we tend to work deductively because we already have the theories. From the industrial age, you start off from Alfred Chandler studying General Motors, and you have that, you know, this is the way the automotive work. And you go through all the organization design work, you go through all the financials, you go, this is how corporations work. But as we're working on service economy, we don't necessarily have all those cases. We don't have all the theories yet, so we may need to work inductively. You have a service system. So as an example, do people really understand, should you open up a company like Uber? Like Uber, like, should you do that? Should you not do it? Like, I don't know. It's a case. It's a single case. Are there enough companies like Uber that you could actually say there's a theory here? The way you would have to do it is you'd have to build the theory. You start from the case and you build up from that. Or the other way thing you could do, and it'll be interesting to see your master's thesis, you could try doing an abductive one. That'd be really fun. Write a science fiction one, which would be a forecasting if we're going to look at a perfect logistics system. A logistics system 10 years from now. This is what a logistics system 10 years from now would be like. And in order to do that, these sorts of things would happen. So I don't know if it could be climate change. It could be the price of petroleum, these sort of things. You could write like a science fiction and you say all these things happen and this will be the result. So the Alexander book, The Battle for Life and Beauty of the Earth, works as an inductive case study. The way that I see it is that he had the Aishan campus. The Aishan campus was a place where it was put up or shut up. He's been teaching about pattern languages, saying there's these patterns and this is the way we should build things, and he has to build a real university campus on it. So we have the case. The result was that he was actually building a campus. We can do this with service systems and actually say that we frame our experiences as places, spaces, and paces. These are our physical, social, and time-oriented things. And we can create a service system around that and create a theory. So we don't really have a good theory of service systems yet, and there's an opportunity to build one. And one of the tricks here, remember we're having this discussion now about process as arrangement in time and structure as arrangement in space, is Alexander has a good idea about unfolding. And the way he thinks about unfolding is you think about a seed and planting a seed and having the seed grow. Architects, you can ask the question, is the building better on day two than on day one? This has been one of the criticisms I heard of Chiasma, which is my favorite museum in the world. Or that or Tokyo. Anyway, Chiasma, when they did the outside of Chiasma, it did not weather very well. And they've had to redo it because every day it got worse. But if there are buildings that we know and we've seen that are really, really old and they've endured, and they're actually just as good now as they were then, and they've been accommodated. Alexander wanted us to be able to design building systems that would improve over time. And he was doing this, and he did this, and I got to go see the Aichi campus. It happened that I was going to Japan. I discovered as I was doing my research, this was actually last year in 2014, I was reading and doing my research, and it was Friday morning, and I discovered this new book, and I looked at it, and I go, oh, I'm actually going to be in Japan next week, so can I go see this? And so I emailed the high school and said, I'd like to come and visit, and it turns out that not many people have done that. This is the Higashino Aishin campus designed by Christopher Alexander. And it was originally tea fields. So you have Tokyo kind of down here in the lower right. And up there you've got it in Aruma. So northwest of Tokyo, there is this site. And this is what the site looks like on Google Maps. It's got a pond that goes around it. You can see various buildings. And it's kind of a regular shape. But before, it was all tea fields. This is what it looks like on Google Earth. It's fun to do this stuff on Google Earth. Now, how was this designed? If you look at the book, the Practice 1985 went on 8 activities. And I'm going to step through each one of these 8 to give you an idea of how pattern languages work. The first thing that that Alexander did was interview on the hopes and dreams of the people. So you have tea fields there, and they wanted to create a new high school that would prepare people for university. So actually, originally it was designed for a combined campus where there would be a high school and a college. But as it turns out, the college never got completed. But it's there. So it start off with that, and you talk about what is it that you're going to design in the campus. And so on the right side here, the main entrance is critical character of the whole campus. The place for the edge of the site must be done with great care. I seen the main entrance of the gate where I could greet students and teachers in the morning. That is not a specification. That is just a dream, right? This is what I want. What do you want in a school? One of the things that the teacher said, and this is a good example of it, is a teacher wants to be able to see the eyes of their students. And this room is really good because I can look at you and I can actually tell when I'm going too fast because people start looking uncomfortable. But I think they're doing okay. You guys are following along. I see some nodding. I see some smiling now and then, so I'm doing okay, right? So for a teacher, that's the sort of thing. But you interview on these hopes and dreams. And then from then, you create a poetic vision as a first sketch of a pattern language. Now, these are not requirements. Again, this is trying to describe aspects of a campus that doesn't yet exist. So the new campus consists of an outer precinct with all the sports fields, gardens, outer buildings. There's an inner precinct. There's an entrance street. There's a main yard, Tennoji Center, home base street. And so this was done just as a first sketch. It was done mostly as language, trying to understand what people really want. Make a rudimentary pattern language physically coherent. Now, this is a part where in computer science, in building IT systems, they say they do pattern language. They tend to do the first two things, which is what computer software do you want? I'll sit you in front of a screen. I'll build this sort of stuff for you. And then they give you that feedback. Then they have to make the pattern language coherent. So they have to make it exist. And so this was a sketch that actually came out. And he has some things that are around it. But in essence, you know, you kind of have this entrance street coming in from the bottom. You've got a crossroads in the middle. That was sort of idea. So that was a very, very rough thing. And then they refine the pattern language through discussion. So going through, you now have this basic idea, and you describe the pattern. The clinical room teacher says they want sun. Political economy and social studies student says they want to see each student's face. They want a bigger desk. They want clear windows. They want calm wood, these sorts of things. These are sort of things that they're having in designing. The guy at the bottom wants a big gym. Number 5, obtain approval of the pattern language. And this actually is a pattern language. So there's 110 patterns, 1.1, an outer boundary surrounds a campus. And so then he describes the campus. It's a wall, 60-centimeter wall based on wooden fence, contained within this outer there's an outer precinct. It looks like this. So this is what the entrance actually looks like when it's actually being constructed. So when you walk up to the front of the high school, there's a slow arc as you go into it. This actually reminds me of Chiasma, actually. You go into Chiasma, and there's a small ramp up. That's architects like to do that. And it gives it a nice feel. And then you get inside, and there's an inner precinct, there's an entrance street, and all that sort of stuff. And so you go through the gate, and this is what it looks like when you go through the gate. I happened to be there on the one snowy day that it was really bad snowstorm. A week after the snowstorms, they had a lot of snow. But that's what the campus looks like. And I'm not going to go through all of them, but they went through, and the interior building character, 8.1 wood, floors and walls in place, pale yellow, floors raised off, and this is the judo hall. with my sons. There's some interesting, this judo hall was actually designed too small. And in the book it's written that at first the physical education instructors didn't want to participate, and by the time they participated, it was like, okay, now you've got those supporting structures in, we already made that decision, so it's pretty tough. And so they actually have extra pads on the wall because people get thrown against the wall too much in judo. You renegotiate the pattern language within space and within budget. So originally they had estimated that it was going to be 17,990 square meters, and it was going to cover 84,000 square meters of land, but they had to make it fit because they only had 67,000 meters square land, which means they may have 13,000 for the buildings. And so they just cut everything down 73%. They made all the buildings smaller, and then they went back and started talking to them and said, well, we can give you a larger building here if you have a smaller building there. The total has to be 13,204 square meters. And they went and they negotiated that. So now they've got essentially the floor space. This is where the system thinking starts coming in number seven. What you've got now is a layout of buildings, and you've got land. And what happens is that you're trying to adjust the buildings and the land at the same time. And so it turns out that you can move the land, but it's difficult to do that, and you can move the buildings. And so what they did was they were trying to figure this out, and they couldn't get everything to work. And what they did was identify the systems of centers. The centers are the biggest features. So if you were doing this as a service, it would be what is it that's most distinctive about the service? What is it that sticks in people's mind? But there is the system, which is the buildings, and there is a containing system, which is the land. So this is how you do systems thinking in architecture. You have the buildings, you have the land, one constrains the other. And so they worked on it. And they also worked on it in the places on the site. So the first one, this one was the buildings. This is how the land is. You have a ridge, you have a swamp, and so there's a low part, there's a high part, and you're trying to fit the buildings and the swamp together. And eventually they worked out that what they had to do was to move the entrance. So they actually used to have the entrance coming in from one direction, and it turned at 90 degrees to everything fit. The last thing that he did was adjust the site plan on the site itself, not on models. So how many of you know, how many of you work in agile development? Anyone here work in agile development? Okay. So this is a principle that comes from agile development, which is kind of anti-planning. If you have a choice between showing them the real thing and showing them a sketch or, you know, a plan, you show them the real thing, right? So Alexander doesn't believe in blueprints. He believes in being on the land. So when he worked on this property, it had tea fields all over it. And what he would do is plant flags on the land. And from that, he would say, okay, you see this curve walking up to the front gate. Should that curve actually be there? And you could do it by drawing it, but you can't actually represent it until you're standing on the land. It's a little bit high, a little bit low, these sorts of things. So it's the same sort of thing that comes out when you're designing a service system or designing a business. You have to ask yourself, are you doing blueprinting, or are you actually implementing a plan in reality? So how many of you, have you heard of minimal viable product? You heard the expression minimal viable product? Yeah. So the idea of minimum viable product is, what is it that you would need in order to demonstrate the system is viable? So when they were starting up Zappos, the shoe company in the United States, it was an online shoe company. What is they actually needed? They needed a website, and then that was actually what they needed. They needed a website. But how did they get the shoes? What they initially did was they went to a retailer and they bought shoes from the retailer. And they just put the catalog on. They didn't have to put up a big distribution system. They didn't make agreements with the manufacturers and do all that. They put up a website, and they started selling shoes. And then they got experience, And they go, oh, well, maybe we need different varieties of shoes. Maybe we need more size. Maybe we need more variety. We need more web pages, these sort of things. And so you don't plan and say, 5 years from now, we're going to be Zappos, the world's largest online shoe retailer. You start off small, and you implement it, and then you work, and then you learn, and you go through this learning loop. And for this, Alexander says, no blueprints. We actually work on the land. We put on flags, we put on markers. This is where the gate goes. This is where the path starts. We're going to have a tree over here. We're going to have the cafeteria over the back, these sorts of things. Now, we've been talking about pattern language. There's an idea of generativity, and generativity is not a property of the parts. It is a property of the interaction between the parts. So I'll give you a little more definition on system thinking. System thinking has this idea of what's called emergence. If you are studying water, there's a property of wetness in water. If you take the water apart, you get hydrogen and oxygen. Wetness is not a property of hydrogen. It is not a property of oxygen. It's a property of the whole. So if you want to study wetness, don't study hydrogen and oxygen. It's not going to get you there. You want to study the whole, not the parts. If you are working on a service system, we talk about transportation systems, you want to understand the service system. Looking at the trams themselves only gets you so far. You can start working on the drivers and working on the mechanics, but you need to appreciate the things that emerge. What happens when the tram is in traffic? What happens when people board and don't board? What happens when the funding changes? These are all things that are generative when you have the system operating with all the parts coming together. So if we think about Alexander's title of the search for life and beauty on the earth, you could be working on all the parts and not have life and not have beauty. So responding to the first question about systems, this is often one of the criticisms of systems is people think they're doing systems thinking, but they're only working on the parts. They're not working on the whole. And if we're trying to improve the whole, we need to keep that part in our minds that we may not be able to generate the beauty or the wholeness. It may emerge from the parts. It may come naturally. And if you actually try to control it, sometimes you destroy it. Now, what are the trade-offs you make in terms of architecting? This is work that I'm developing, but if we think about the way that we design service systems, we can design at scale, scope, and speed, and there's speed and acceleration, which is both our paces. But traditionally, when we've been talking about industrial businesses have been designed around scale. The bigger, the better, right? So oil companies are designed as bigger is better. That doesn't mean they have to be done that way, but there's been a lot of things that have been driven towards machines. We can also design for scope, and so it could be something that's multifunction. It could be a set of customers. And so the ultimate enterprise for scope would be one where you have like instant butler, the service that does everything for you. It doesn't do it necessarily at scale, but it satisfies the one person very well. We can also do it in terms of speed. Now, when you get to scale, scope, and speed, it's usually pick 2 out of 3, right? You can't do all of them. So you can do something large scale, you may be able to have a wide scope, but it's going to be slow. Or you can have something at scale and speed, but very narrow. Or you can have something at small scale, high variety in scope, and really fast. But remember, we're talking about Bateson, and we're talking about different types of learning. Acceleration is a double loop learning. How fast can you change the system? So we have single loop and double loop learning here. But when we think about architecting systems, these are the basics that I see. You get up, you have a choice between scale, scope, and speed, sometimes acceleration for change, and we can design in different ways for different aspects. You can't have them all. Just to close off this section, one of the things I find about Alexander, and I get a little philosophical here, is that mainstream architecture, urban design are rationalistic and teleological. Teleological means it is goal-seeking. Alexander is ateleological. So in the case of first row here, you have ultimate purpose. There's a development philosophy that says, we're going to build for this. Alexander says, you can't do that. If you're going to design a building, you don't necessarily design a building to optimize. So if you watch the videos on how buildings learn, there's a contrast between the MIT Media Lab, which is a function, it was designed as a building just for high tech, and they have this other hall, which is a long hall, that has been used by startup companies. And the question is, which is better designed? Well, it turns out that if you just have a long hall, you can put up non-load-bearing walls, and so a company starts off as a startup company, it's really small, and it expands a little bit, and expands a little bit, and it's no problem, and then eventually they get so big they move out of the building, and then it collapses down again, right? And companies come and go, they contrast, you know, easy. That is part of not having a goal. You design something without a specific function. Whereas if you actually go into the media lab, turns out they're having problems because there are walls that come up in the wrong place and you can't meet people. You have to go down the elevator to go across and up another elevator. These sort of things are because they were designed for goals and purposes. When you have teleology, you design for efficiency. When you have ateleology, you design for homeostasis. The design focus on teleology is for ends or results. There's means. So the design is different, and it's actually a design philosophy that's different. So the reason I'm proposing and moving towards a pattern language is the architects that have worked with Christopher Alexander say, oh, you could take the pattern language and create a bad building. Absolutely correct. You could take all the patterns and just name them and say, I'm going to put in the right intensity gradient, and it still is wrong. It's still an ugly building. That's okay, because it also helps you describe good buildings. It doesn't guarantee it. It's not goal-oriented. But it's a different way of working. One of the design issues is one of a third from the bottom. Are you designing for complexity and conflict, or are you designing for time? If you're designing over a long period of time, something that's going to last for a long time, you don't know what the functions are, you don't know what the needs are going to be 50 years from now. If you're going to design a building that's going to last 50 years, it better be flexible enough to change. It better be able to shift without having to be torn down. Okay. That's a taste of pattern languages. I hope to come back sometime, a year or two, and work with people and actually start generating pattern languages around service systems. But what I'm going to do is give you some more background around the way that we think about systems. We're going to talk about the design of inquiring systems. I'm going to talk about the origin of Wiki, because it has to do with the way we collaborate. And I'm going to talk about Federated Wiki, which is a new advance about the way we might collaborate in the future. So there are five ways of knowing. I'm going to describe, these are five inquiring systems. So these are all systems. They'll have input, process, output, and they follow all the categories. But they have parts and wholes, all sorts of things. But the question essentially is, how do you know? And you're going to get into this when you do your research methods. How do you actually know? Okay, the first way of knowing is inductive consensual. So the guarantee here is agreement. How do we know the world is round? Very few of us get to experience that. So let's say the world is flat. If we get everyone here to agree in the room the world is flat, the world is flat. That is an inductive, consensual, inquiring system. It's inductive because we have this thing in front of us. We say it's the world, we say it's flat, and we agree. And a lot of the world works off inductive, consensual, inquiring systems. We know things because people say that's common sense. There's also analytic deductive inquiring systems. This one is logical consistency. So you're going to hire someone, and so you design on the criteria. So how is it we know that Satu is good for this job? Well, okay, we create the scorecard. And what we do is that we go and say, oh, they should have leadership ability, they should have research, they should have funding, all sorts of stuff. They have all these sort of attributes. And you go, you take all the candidates and you score them. And this person got the highest score, so they must be the best for the job, right? It turns out this is the wrong way to do it. Inductive consensual inquiring systems, analytic deductive inquiring systems are very common. People do scorecarding a lot. But if you were actually looking at the way you design a system, Russell Acoff suggests you do it the other way. What you do is you take a look and say, if we had this person in this job, what would the program turn out to be? So you have someone who's more conservative, then they're going to have the program, it'll be this way. You have someone who's more radical, the program's going to go this way. You have someone who's more of an academic, the program goes this way. You have someone who's more of a teacher, more of a researcher. It leads to different directions. But the reason you have to be careful about analytic deductive inquiring systems is the scorecard isn't real. And if you have a person standing in front of you and you're evaluating candidates for a job, what happens is they are real. And so we end up with these sorts of situations where you end up with a half male, half female sort of, you know, you see those situations where, you know, on average you're correct, but, you know, you're half male, half female, these sorts of things. Those all come out of the analytic deductive inquiring system. There's a third way of knowing, multiple realities inquiring system. And what this says is that the model and data are an inseparable whole and the guarantor is the ability to see. For those of you who don't know philosophy, this is Kant. And what this means is that I know systems thinking. I believe that each of you now know system thinking, but we can't know in the same way. Because we have a model in our head, and we see the same picture, but we don't think about it the same way. And so having a scorecard, independent, all these sort of things, it doesn't work. So if there's a drug problem, why is there a drug problem? The reason there's a drug problem could be, it could be economic, it could be political, it could be social. And if you're trained as an economist, you see problems as economic problems. You trained as a sociologist, you see them as sociology problems. The fourth way of knowing, dialectic inquiring system, you have a guarantor, which is conflict. This is the way the French legal system works. You have a debate. One side takes black, the other one takes white, and they debate. And they say, this is true, this is false, this is true, this is false. And what they're looking for is an observer that can observe the gray. And only the person that is observing learns. The person arguing black may or may not believe in black. The person arguing white may or may not believe in white. But they're arguing that for the sake of the inquiring system. Now you put all these into an inquiring system where you have progress as a guarantor. And so when I design inquiring systems, I design conferences, I design them this way. And what we do is that we try to get multiple perspectives and we try to bring them all together. Everyone gets to be an observer, everyone gets to be a participant. Okay, so this has been quite philosophical. I'm going to explain to you why this is important. Because we have Wiki. Everyone knows Wiki, Wikipedia, right? Which inquiring system is a Wikipedia? Wikipedia is an inductive consensual inquiring system. If it's on Wikipedia, it must be true, right? Or is it? And this is a problem we have. So if we're looking at writing a pattern language, and now this is the thing people don't appreciate, the wiki technology was invented by Ward Cunningham to support the development of a pattern language for software development. Pattern languages were used because if you stop and think about the patterns and the way they were done, they all link to each other, so they're like hyperlinks, right? But when pattern language started off, that technology didn't exist. So Ward Cunningham invented Wiki to support pattern language. And they had this pattern language. And so this is a C2 Wiki, the original Wiki, and it still exists. But there is a new Wiki. Ward Cunningham, there's actually an interesting article written in Wired Magazine called Ward Cunningham Puts a Fork in His Wiki. And it is designed because there's possible to write multiple perspectives. And so each one of you could have your own wiki, and you can copy off each other. How many of you have used GitHub? Anyone use GitHub? Git? Okay, Git. Okay, so for those of you who aren't in computer science, people must know what Linus Torvalds' first invention was. Everyone knows Linus Torvalds, right? Linux? His first invention was Linux. His second invention was Git. Why did you have Git? The reason was, when you were doing software development, the traditional way of working together is check in, check out. So it's like a library. You go to the library, you take out the book, you check out the book, you work on the book, you put the book back on the shelf, right? You have a library, but that means that when you check the book out, no one else can work on the book. In effect, you lock the library. When a person takes out one book out of the library, you lock the library till they're done, and they put the book back. And you say, my book had nothing to do with that. I didn't want that book. Sorry, we locked the whole library. Git was invented so people could work in parallel and work together. But it suffers from the problem that it's inductive consensual, that we can't actually have people arguing or debating while it's in progress. So if you actually look on Wikipedia and you look on my talk page, I've actually been going back and forth with them because in doing my research, I discovered that there's a page for one of the people that his name is Dale Dougherty, and he's the guy that is the editor of Make Magazine. He's the guy that started the Maker movement. And so I think he's notable. And I was doing research, I go, why is there not a Wikipedia page? Well, it turns out there is a Wikipedia page, but someone thought, well, he wasn't notable, so they made it redirected, so he doesn't exist on Wikipedia. And so now I'm debating with him and saying, look, this guy invented the Maker movement. He's the one that created the term Web 2.0. You know, that's enough. He's pretty notable. I think he deserves a page on Wikipedia. Why'd you guys remove it? And it's because, in effect, they said, no, it's not good enough. Well, if I had my Wikipedia, my own Wikipedia, then I would have a page for this guy. And what the new technology is looking for, everyone should have their own Wikipedia. And they should all be networked together. So here's Ward. For those of you interested in the smallest federated wiki, you can surf over, you can search on it and find. He has created a new wiki technology. And this is not an inductive consensual wiki. This is a place where people could interact. So there's an opportunity for you, maybe a little early, maybe we'll get it for next year, for people to work on their master's thesis as a wiki project. So we kind of conventionally, and this is where we start getting into the breakthrough thinking that originally we started in 2006 when we started this program, is how do people learn and how do people interact, how do you communicate? So what if we had you write your thesis on a wiki? As opposed to doing it in a bound book. Like, with today's search engines, how many people read the bound book and how many people read the wiki? They'll probably find the wiki faster, right? So if everyone had a wiki, you could write it, you could update it. If you had a way of sharing across wikis, you could actually both have multiple people write on the same topic, and it would be okay that they're slightly different because they've had different experiences. They have different views of the world. You don't have to have just one Wikipedia. You can have multiple inquiry systems at play simultaneously. People can know different things in the same way, in different ways. I've gone through and I've started experimenting with it. So on the pages I've got, there's a generative pattern language. I went back to 1968 when Christopher Alexander did it, and I created some patterns and created things that excerpt some of it. So I've been working on this, and we'll see how it goes. So that brings us pretty well to the end of the talk. I'm not going to talk about these last slides. I'm going to close out because we've covered most of the material. What do you think? Let me give you the proposition here, which is you are being asked to write a master's thesis. What is the form of that thesis? How is it you're going to approach that? I'll give you the easy, quick way, which is if you want to do a deductive thesis. Have a theory, find a case, and prove it. That is one way of doing a thesis. That is not the only way of doing a thesis. You could also do a case one and build theory. Or you can do the more creative thing and try a science fiction thing. But there's multiple ways to do it. I believe that there's an opportunity for different ways of learning. I believe that we're at the beginning of service systems. There's a lot more work to be done. So if you would do actually inductive work, write about your experiences in the companies and organizations you're working in, and write about how their service systems. You put on a wiki, we can find it, and we can build theory together. And so that concludes my talk for today, and I'll take some questions, but I think that's it. Thank you.
Would do their kind of if everyone around, we could build so many theories on different things if we just engage everyone who's working in corporations. I'll leave you to talk to them.
Hi. You know Emma. This is Emma.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
I was wondering who was there. It's you, Emma.
Yes.
I think you kind of in Finland when you were here with your sister and your mom.
Was it
in 2001? You lived in Kilo.
Karakallio.
Mm-hmm. I came to, because your mom was working in the same workplace I was in Otaniemi, Helsinki University of Technology.